John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for July 7th to 13th, 2012. Palestinian Authority under financial pressure to resume peace talks. Civil servants receive partial salary this week amidst an increasing Israeli settler and military violence. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent activities in the West Bank. Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress anti-wall protests organized in a number of West Bank communities this week. IMEMC's Jack Moore with the details.
A Dutch national sustained a head injury after being hit by a tear gas canister, and dozens of others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli troops attacked demonstrators at the separation wall near Bilayin. About 80 people, both Palestinian and internationals, took part in the weekly protest in the small village of Bilayin this afternoon. The weekly protest is aimed at halting the construction of the illegal separation wall being erected by Israel inside the occupied West Bank. Villagers from Bilayin were joined by about 25 internationals, who then marched from the village to the wall, chanting slogans denouncing the illegal occupation. The Israeli army responded by firing salvos of tear gas canisters at the demonstrators. One international activist was struck in the back of the head, causing serious injury. Dozens of others suffered from the effects of tear gas inhalation. The Israeli army fired dozens of tear gas canisters towards the demonstrators, despite the fact that many children were present. In the village of Nabi Saleh, northwest of Ramallah, a demonstration resulted in arrests and use of wastewater by the occupation forces. The march began in Martyrs Square and continued throughout the streets until reaching Shahid Mustafa Al-Tamimi Street, where soldiers and patrolmen were waiting. The soldiers and patrolmen then began to spray the demonstration and its participants with wastewater. In the southern West Bank city of Al-Mazara, the Israeli army forced demonstrators into the village after they had attempted to march to the separation barrier to protest the illegal land grabs by Israeli settlers. For IMEMC News, this is Jack Muir.
The United States threatens to cut aid to the Palestinian Authority, who is already in a serious financial crisis. The details and more with IMEMC's Elena Johnson.
Khaled Mesmar, head of the political committee of the Palestinian National Council, said that an official statement issued by Washington had been received, demanding that if another membership bid was put to the United Nations, then all financial aid to the Palestinian Authority would be cut. Mesmar stated that the threat was issued officially via the American administration envoy, who visited Ramallah recently and met with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The initial bid for membership was blocked in September 2011 when the UN Security Council was put under pressure by the American delegation not to vote for it. Mesmar reported that the Palestinian leadership would withhold its UN bid for statehood if Israel stopped building settlements and released the Palestinian prisoners that were detained before the Oslo Agreement of 1993. The Israeli settlements have been the major obstacle to all negotiations. Despite settlements being illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention and being in defiance of UN resolutions and the World Court, Israel refuses to halt their construction, making negotiations impossible. The importance of a fresh UN bid has taken on huge significance since last October, when UNESCO voted to admit Palestine as its newest member. The U.S. immediately cut off all aid to UNESCO. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee referred to vote, which passed with a 107-14 majority, as reckless and anti-Israel. In the meantime, the Palestinian Authority paid part of the June salaries to the Palestinian civil servants this week. Salaries, which are usually paid on the 7th of each month, have not been paid due to aid to the PA being delayed. Nabil Kassis of the PA Ministry of Finance stated that 60% of nearly 160,000 employees' salaries would be transferred to their bank accounts today. Kassis stated that the PA is facing its worst crisis in recent years due to a lack of promised funds being delivered. To date, the PA has received only $466 million of $1.2 billion promised this year. The U.S., which had pledged $200 million, failed to deliver in June as promised. Saudi Arabia had promised $95 million, but as yet, this has not been received. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is expected to visit Saudi Arabia in the coming days to discuss the crisis. Secretary General of the PLO, Yasser Abid Rabu, explained that Abbas has chosen to visit Saudi Arabia as it has always been supportive to the PA at all levels. Also this week, the Palestinian Authority has agreed to the exhumation of late President Yasser Arafat's body following the recent expose by the Al Jazeera network. The recent Al Jazeera broadcast showed findings by the Institute of Radiation Physics in Switzerland that suggested that Arafat had been poisoned with polonium-210 following tests on the late president's clothing. While the findings of the Institute of Radiation Physics could not conclusively prove that Arafat was killed by poisoning, tests on his remains would give a final conclusion with regards to his death. Since his death in 2004, it has been widely speculated that Arafat was poisoned after he fell gravely ill and died 1 month later. For IMEMC News, this is Elena Johnson.
Israeli settler and military violence escalate against the Palestinian population in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, with more than 60 incursions into Palestinian communities. The details and more with IMEMC's Kelly Joyner.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights released its weekly report on the West Bank and Gaza today. They reported that the Israeli military continued to use force to disperse peaceful protesters, resulting in injuries to four Palestinians, including one child. Israeli forces also carried out widespread abductions. Two Palestinian civilians and three human rights defenders were kidnapped during nonviolent protests. 26 Palestinians, including seven children, were abducted during incursions into the West Bank by the Israeli military. There were 63 reported incursions this week alone. In Hebron, after two separate incidents involving Israeli military and settler violence, the Israeli army shut down the old city. A teenage girl and a French citizen were wounded in successive days by Israeli fire. In Jerusalem, an Eritrean family lost their home and suffered smoke inhalation after an arson attack that was motivated by racism. Many African migrants have been targeted in Israel lately by right-wing extremist groups who want Israel to be a Jewish-only state. In related news, Israeli settlers were responsible for the destruction of 120 olive trees south of Nablus, the confiscation of a 5-dunam area in Al-Hadr village south of Bethlehem, and in Nabi Yunus, north of Hebron, settlers attacked Palestinian civilians in their vehicles. In Gaza, Israeli warplanes launched renewed airstrikes and an incursion into Khan Yunis, as well as firing on Palestinians inside Gaza. Mahmoud Al-Haji was killed by an Israeli airstrike on Thursday that also leveled large portions of Palestinian land. One Palestinian man was shot by Israeli forces while picking up scrap for recycling. Israel has continued its total closure of both land and water borders in Gaza as well. Also in Gaza, 5 children were injured by an unexploded ordnance, a UXO, according to a United Nations report. Since the beginning of 2012, 17 other children have been wounded by UXOs in Gaza, and an additional 9 Palestinians were also injured. These injuries resulted in at least one death. In addition, one man was abducted at a Erez crossing while attempting to cross into Israel to seek medical attention. While en route to hospital, the Palestinian patient was detained and abducted at Beit Hanun. The artistic director of the Freedom Theater in Jenin began a hunger strike this week to protest his administrative detention by the Israeli military. He is one of an estimated 320 Palestinians currently in prison without charges under Israeli military administrative detention orders. There are currently 4,700 Palestinians in Israeli military prisons, which includes 185 children. Palestinian footballer Mahmoud Sarsak was released this week after a hunger strike of 96 days protesting his administrative detention. After being detained while attempting to attend a football match, he lost nearly half his body weight on his hunger strike. For IMEMC News, this is Kelly Joyner.
That was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rishmawi.
Combatants for Peace is an organization made up of former Israeli soldiers and former Palestinian fighters who have concluded that violence will not lead to a just and peaceful settlement in the Middle East. They condemn Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands and support a two-state solution based in part on Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Combatants for Peace members often travel to speak in the U.S., always in pairs. On July 15th, Israeli Erez Crispin and Palestinian Noor Shahada joined more than 200 local residents in New Haven, Connecticut's third annual I Wage Peace Walk, organized by local billboard company owner, peace activist and filmmaker Bruce Barrett. The walk calls on all people of goodwill, especially Christians, Jews, and Muslims, to work for peace in Israel-Palestine. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Crispin and Shahada after the peace walk. She began by asking their opinions on the recent report by an Israeli government-appointed panel known as the Levy Committee that stated, contrary to international law, settlements in the West Bank are legal, affirming Israel's long-held position. The report also concluded that most unauthorized outposts, up to now considered illegal by the Israeli government, should also be officially recognized. Israeli Erez Crispin responded first.
It's the Levy Committee, which was appointed by the government, the Israeli government, and decided what the government of Israel, the current right-wing government of Israel, wanted to hear and decide. But this is a political committee. It wasn't a judicial committee. The settlements are illegal. Any settlement is illegal according to the international law. It is the number one obstacle for peace and for settlement with the Palestinians. They are located, the settlements are located in a way that you cannot create a Palestinian state, a contiguous Palestinian state. And that's our message, that the United States finally has to object the industry of settlement and be active, implicitly and actively, against this problem for peace.
Noor, as a Palestinian, what do you think of this development?
This land, all the people in the world agree in 1967, is Palestinian land. How we can take a decision to illegal building in this land? It's not Israeli land. How we can take decision for not your land? This is a problem. I think this is put a lot of big stones on the way of the peace. It's make a trouble of the peace. I am not agree this decision. I hope the Israeli government we can take decision to serve peace, to do peace, to make peace, not make a decision to be war, to be new intifada.
Do you think that that decision could lead to another intifada by Palestinians if they feel like it just is dashing any hope of a settlement where Palestine could have an actual functioning country, a two-state solution?
I can't tell you, but it's reason because the settlement we will eat all the Palestinian land in 1967. The settlement it's expanded in Palestine. It's very very big problem. It's the first problem now to make peace, to build a state in Palestinian land. Where is the state when the settlement is expanded more than this? Where is the Palestinian state?
I just read today that in accordance with the settlement from the hunger strike, the Palestinian prisoners, that they've started allowing some of the Gaza prisoners from Gaza to have family visits, but there's a lot of restrictions. You know, do you see that as a positive development?
There are certain laws, international laws, regarding how can you treat prisoners and detainees. And Israel currently doesn't give all that it needs to give in terms of rights to these prisoners. There is a good step forward in recent weeks, resulting probably due to negotiation between the Israeli government and Hamas. I hope that it continues and they will give them the rights that they deserve as detainees, as prisoners. And I hope that they will release most of them, because most of them are in prison without trial. And some of them deserve to be in jail, most of them not.
There's been talk about getting Hamas together with Fatah and some kind of a unity government, which has been not the case since 2006 or 7. Do you think that would help lead to a two-state solution between Palestine and Israel if the Palestinian factions get together? Or do you think that isn't where the Palestinians need to go? Noor?
Hamas, it's one of the faction in Palestine. The people from Hamas is the Palestinian people. It's no differences between people from Hamas and people from Fatah. All the people fighting to be a freedom. I think when Hamas and Fatah we make an agreement, it's give a lot of power for the peace. It's give big chance to do a peace. We need to go to the non-violent struggle. This is the important thing for me.
Erez, as an Israeli, what do you think?
I think that there is a window of opportunity now. Hamas is on the fence from several reasons. We can attract them. We can give them all the reasons to support the two-state solution, to support the existence of Israel, or we can distract them. We can give them all the reasons to return to the path of violence. I think that it's not only the Fatah, it's also up to the Israeli government to decide if they want negotiations with Hamas, because there will be negotiations, the same way that there weren't negotiations with Fatah, and at some point the Israeli government realized that it's better to attract these factions and to talk to them. I hope that the same decision will be made regarding Hamas.
That was Israeli Erez Crispin and Palestinian Noor Shahada, members of the group Combatants for Peace. Find more information about Combatants for Peace and other organizations working for Middle East peace on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, 17th of July. NATO reported that a soldier of unreported nationality was killed by an insurgent attack in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 17th of July. A NATO helicopter crashed in western Afghanistan, wounding two soldiers of unreported nationality. Afghanistan, 18th of July. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 19th of July. NATO is reporting the death of two soldiers of unreported nationality from IED blasts, one in eastern Afghanistan and one in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 18th of July. At least 18 NATO oil tank trucks were burned in Rabotak area, Samangan province. Provincial Security Chief General Khalil Andarabi confirmed the report, saying the convoy included 18 oil tankers and four other trucks of NATO supplies. Pakistan, 17th of July. Oil tankers planning to depart via the reopened Pakistani route were unable to depart. The claimed reason was that the security checkpoints had yet to be set up and that oil companies had yet to fill the trucks. Apparently, NATO was yet to pay some of the bills for previous shipments to Afghanistan, even though those shipments were over half a year ago. General Secretary of All Pakistan Oil Tankers Owners Association has insisted that the previous bills be paid before any tank trucks head to NATO forces in Afghanistan. The bills have no more been forgotten than that deadly U.S. airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers last year. Although the border has officially been reopened to NATO traffic, very few trucks have traveled to Afghanistan from Pakistan since the theoretical reopening of that route. Afghanistan, 20th of July. A roadside bomb killed five Afghan policemen, including a district police chief, when it blew up their car in southern Afghanistan. First, the Taliban attacked the checkpoint. When the district chief and his police bodyguards showed up to investigate, the roadside bomb took them out. Mr. Barack Obama, none of this has gotten any easier for U.S. forces or their puppets during your time in office. Delaying withdrawal until 2014 may save the election, but it means two more years of war and death. Now is the time to throw in the towel. Bring all the troops home today. Guantanamo Bay. If you were detained there, you wouldn't even know that Bush had ever left the White House. In fact, things have gotten worse under Obama's administration for many inmates in Guantanamo Bay. Those cleared for release have found their cases in limbo, sitting on their heels for nothing in one of Earth's worst prisons.
On July 10th, the U.S. released Ibrahim Ahmed Cosey, who had been held since 2002 at the nation's Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. Cosey, a native of Sudan, was convicted by a 2010 military tribunal of providing support to al-Qaeda's now-deceased leader, Osama bin Laden, as a driver, cook, and bookkeeper. Although nearly 800 men have been imprisoned at Guantanamo since the camp opened in January 2002, only seven have received trials for their alleged crimes. Of the 168 men who remain prisoners at Guantanamo, 87 have never been charged with a crime or received a trial. The Obama administration's own review task force, the Pentagon, intelligence and law enforcement agencies, conducted a review of the status of Guantanamo prisoners in 2009 and concluded that these 87 detainees posed no danger to the U.S., yet these prisoners remain in legal limbo. Although President Obama pledged to close Guantanamo during his 2008 presidential campaign and signed an executive order to do so shortly after taking office, the detention camp appears to be very far away from closing its doors. Part of the problem lies with Congress, which used its spending authority to withhold funds that prevented the White House from transferring Guantanamo detainees to the U.S. to stand trial in civilian courts or move these prisoners to an Illinois state penitentiary to be held indefinitely. Your reporter spoke with Bahar Azmi, legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses efforts to gain the release of detainees being held at Guantanamo who continue to be indefinitely imprisoned without charge or trial.
There are currently 168 detainees in Guantanamo, and surprisingly, I think probably most people don't know that the past 18 months in Guantanamo has seen the fewest number of releases or repatriations basically in the history of Guantanamo. That's in part because Congress has restricted the president's ability to return individuals to their home country to try people on U.S. soil. But it's also in part based on the timidity of the Obama administration and their unwillingness to genuinely push back against Congress and effectuate the kinds of releases and transfers from Guantanamo that are necessary to close the prison. And the Cosey piece is interesting because he's actually pled guilty to a war crime, and it's not sure those charges are valid. But it's worth remembering that of the 168 remaining detainees, 87 have been cleared for release by the Obama administration's Guantanamo Task Force. What does that mean? All of the relevant agencies that supervise Guantanamo, Defense Department, State Department, CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, unanimously concluded that these 87 should be transferred from Guantanamo because they pose no current threat to the United States or our allies. Yet those 87 remain, and it's utterly unconscionable that the jailer would continue to imprison individuals the jailer itself thinks don't belong there.
Bahar, what is it that your organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is doing right now to try and change the current situation so that these detainees will no longer be in legal limbo?
Well, it's particularly challenging these days because the original promise of the Supreme Court's 2008 decision in the Boumediene versus Bush case has been largely forsaken by the lower courts. So that largely means that the courts are not really a viable option in the way that we thought it would be, and has forced us to think about other advocacy and political mechanisms. We've brought a historic case in an international tribunal, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, in which we will challenge the legality of certain policies in Guantanamo. We're attempting to put pressure on the U.S. government to repatriate a bulk of detainees who are cleared for release to Yemen. We're trying to work with other countries to encourage them to accept detainees for resettlement and hope to solicit others, your listeners and other progressives in this country, to hold the president to his promise to close Guantanamo down, particularly in an election year, and not to take his base for granted.
Well, just finally, Bahar Azmi, Americans generally like to take pride in their country as a democracy, upholding the rights of defendants in our court system. But obviously, since 9/11, a lot of the thinking about the rights of those detained, guilty or innocent or unknown, has gone out the window. And I'm wondering, do you see any trend lines that give you hope that we'll get back to a system that's respected here and around the world in terms of having a judicial system that actually works on behalf of everyone, not just those who are in favor politically at the moment? Obviously, people suspected of terrorism are not in favor. And as we see in Guantanamo, they are now suffering the consequences.
I think you've identified the problem, which is that we have constructed an alternate system of justice for Muslims and Arabs. And these rules, whether in Guantanamo or I think prosecutions in the U.S. criminal justice system, are reserved primarily for this other entity of Muslims and Arabs, despite the relative security in this country in the past several years. I don't currently see any signs of hope among the political branches, but I do continue to see lots of people who remain engaged and outraged by this practice. And I think ultimately what's going to have to happen to end it will have to happen in the same way it's happened with other social movements, which is that Muslims in this country need to stand up and become more political and voice their objections and build coalitions with other like-minded individuals to say that these kinds of practices have to stop.
That was Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. For more information about the international campaign to close the U.S. Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. On the 17th of July, Occupy DC marched carrying furniture to the Bank of America branch at 14th and Vermont Avenue Northwest with the intention of entering the branch and occupying the lobby. Unfortunately, somebody at Bank of America was expecting Occupy DC to show up, and as a result, both the front door and the back door inside 1090 Vermont Avenue that also leads to Bank of America were both locked. With both the front gate and the back gate barred, Occupy DC set up in front of the bank branch, with one person sitting blocking the door for a while. And the same table and chair that were going to be used inside the lobby were set up outside. Occupy DC stayed there all afternoon till the bank closed at 5 p.m. And that front door to Bank of America stayed closed all afternoon. After an hour or so, security guards started escorting what few customers showed up in through the back door going through the side doors of 1090 Vermont Avenue.
Fuck Bank of America.
They took my home.
They got bailouts.
They got bailouts.
They didn't do anything good with them.
They didn't do anything good with them.
They wasted the money.
They wasted the money.
CEO bonuses.
So we add an extra layer of security.
It's done. We shut them down.
The siege began at about 1:30 p.m. For about an hour, all the doors were locked. 1090 Vermont was only letting people in that were going upstairs. After over an hour, bank security started escorting people in by the side doors or to the ATM. The bank lobby quickly emptied out. There were very few people in there for the rest of the day, as few customers would approach. Finally, 5 p.m., bank security left, and Occupy DC stayed. Whatever happened to Occupy DC dying with a whimper, Washington Examiner? In Seattle, on the 10th of July, a police SWAT team smashed down the door of a home in which members of Occupy Seattle and the Red Spark Collective lived. They stormed in throwing concussion grenades like they expected all-out armed resistance, the kind they would have gotten in Afghanistan. According to a report posted to www.occupywallstreet.org, a neighbor reported, quote, "Suddenly we heard the bang of their grenade and crashing as the police entered the apartment. The crashing and stomping continued for a long time as they tore the place apart. When it was over, nobody had been arrested, and the search warrant papers listed only anarchist material and clothing worn at a May Day protest as the items to be searched for and stolen. Nobody was arrested, as it is not illegal to be an anarchist. In exactly one way, the residents of this home were lucky. They were not suspected of being Muslims. Had they been Muslims, the SWAT team might have opened fire on sight, and everyone would have been arrested without charges. I wonder how those pigs in the SWAT team would like to try that in Afghanistan, where they would face powerful and effective resistance. Still, this raid indicates, well, first they came for the Muslims, then they came for environmental and animal rights activists, and now they are coming for the Occupy movement and anarchists. Will they come for you tomorrow if you don't vote a straight GOP ticket and have a perfect attendance record at work and at a fundamentalist church? On the 16th of July, Greenpeace activists managed to blockade and shut down a total of 74 shale gas stations in London and Edinburgh in Britain. They were protesting Shell's plans to conduct BP-style offshore oil drilling in the Arctic off places like the northern coast of Alaska, where the kind of response that kept BP's Macondo oil spill would take not 2 months, but a full year, if it was possible at all, with the remnants of the fast-melting polar ice in the way. Here is part of the report posted by The Guardian. Quote, "Protesters have scaled the roof of the Shell station on Queenstown Road near Battersea Park in London and on Dalreep Road in Edinburgh, with police and fire crews attending the scene in Edinburgh. Activists arrived at the Battersea Park branch at 6:45 a.m. and used the station's barriers to close down the forecourt. They have since covered the Shell sign with a Save the Arctic banner and positioned a life-size polar bear model on the station's roof. The activists are shutting down the stations by using an emergency shutoff switch to stop fuel going to the pumps and then removing a fuse to delay it being switched on again. The organization has since posted a picture of an activist removing one of the fuses to Shell's head of Arctic drilling with the message, quote, "We're being careful not to destroy property. Even the carefully removed components will go back to Shell. Unfortunately, any oil spilled in the Arctic by Shell won't be so carefully put back underground." Aftermath of week-long power outages caused by the June 29th Derrico storms, the union representing Pepco's linemen is blaming short staffing for the length of the power outages. IBEW 1900 President Jim Griffin says, quote, "Staffing, especially of linesmen, is half of what it was 20 years ago. These are the folks that are vital to keeping the lights on, and we've just been decimated." He blames the switch to out-of-state contract workers for further aggravating matters, saying, quote, "They're here today and gone tomorrow, leaving us to pick up the pieces.
As of right now, Pepco and Local 1900 are negotiating a new contract. Maybe now it's time to put the squeeze on Pepco. What with the millions of dollars in salary, Pepco CEO Joe Rigsby was paid for last year's performance. Hey Pepco, cutting linemen while global warming brews up more and bigger storms is just another form of climate change denial. Is that why you keep buying electricity generated with coal from mountaintop removal mines, too? Burn up the tar sands. Would they say that we were dumb? Walking in your footsteps.
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 Walking in your footsteps. You may remember the November 19th 2011 takeover of Franklin School at 13th and K Streets by Free Franklin, supported by Occupy DC. On the 12th of July, the defendants from the civil disobedience case who had taken their cases to trial, having been convicted but received sentences only of a $50 payment to the Victims of Crimes Fund, 5 days suspended jail time, and 3 months unsupervised probation, gathered in front of Franklin School to speak about the occupation of the site of the former Franklin Shelter for the Homeless that former Mayor Fenney closed in 2008.
This is about the people versus the money. We are on K Street, where what used to be the Franklin Homeless Shelter is in back of us. K Street, of course, is where the billions of dollars come in to corrupt the people who pretend to be our leaders. And so I guess they figured that that was a bad place to have regular people or homeless people or people who don't have a lot of money running around. So they decided to close the Franklin Shelter. The Franklin Shelter, on one rainy September day in 2008, was suddenly closed at 6 a.m. The people driven out into the street, many of them without their belongings, while police with megaphones shouted at people to stay away, and people not knowing what to do stayed in the rain the entire weekend, many of them without their gear, many of them losing a lot of their possessions on the way. But that didn't matter, of course, because they were people who, without a lot of money. And we decided that we were going to reopen the Franklin Shelter.
Yeah.
And we were up there, as we have admitted in court. We dropped the incriminating banner, as we admitted in court. And the reaction of the crowd below when we did that was tremendous. We knew we had done the right thing. When we heard the cheers and the applause, and I guess the hope from the crowd that once again, as was done in 2002 and 2003, we would be able to open this shelter in the middle of the city. When the police came, we still had a crowd. The reaction was very endearing. Everything from people throwing themselves under fire engines to standing in front of fire engines to, once we were taken off the roof, throwing themselves on the hoods of the paddy wagon. We waited about 8 months for a trial.
We were found guilty of unlawful entry today. And I think that despite the fact that that was probably a direct result of the fact that our judge did us a grave disservice in not allowing us to fully use the good faith belief argument, that we actually, the 13 of us, originally actually believed that we had a right, that we had the authority of the community to enter this building, this publicly owned building.
And unfortunately, the jury followed instructions, as people still are doing today. People are following way too many instructions from a government that has shown itself both incompetent and undeserving to rule.
I think that we used our right to a jury trial the way that it's supposed to be used, which was to get the information and get to the root of the problem that we were discussing to people that otherwise would not have been exposed to it. And even though we were found guilty of unlawful entry, I believe that the only thing we're guilty of is that we went into the Franklin School, previously the Franklin Shelter, on November 19th, and pointed out to the DC government that they're not doing their job by refusing to meet the needs of the community. And I believe that that's the real reason why we were found guilty and slapped on the wrist with 3 months of probation, no community service because we already serve our community, and $50 for the Victims of Crime Fund, which I'm happy to pay into. But also know that I'm doing my part to prevent that real crimes happen, which is the crimes of corruption in government, the crimes of the fact that, you know, corporations and private developers are prioritized in our city versus low-income people, in particular low-income people of color. So I'm really proud to be, to have been part of the 13 people that helped to bring this issue to light. And though specifically we were here at this historic building that stands as a beam of hope for the hundreds upon hundreds of homeless men that used its services before, I believe that the real issue is that the Franklin School is just one of the many buildings in our city that aren't being used to meet the needs of the community. And so until that happens, I hope that more people take the example of, instead of waiting for solutions from above, from elected officials who clearly aren't listening to their constituents, that they show, but that they, you know, invoke action, and that they model what they want to see the city be like.
I myself was not happy with the guilty verdict. It was clear to me that at least four people on the jury were in our favor, did believe in what we were doing, and didn't believe that we had broken any laws whatsoever, even in the system's belief of what the crime was that we had committed. I do feel that due to the judge constantly stopping us from saying what we had to say, trying to stop us from getting our political beliefs, and also her very strict telling of what the jury could and could not deliberate about, I think affected our affected the jury's decision, and pretty much set us up to get a guilty verdict. I feel that this is just one of the many problems going on in D.C. right now and across the country, where too many times the system is scared to allow people to empower themselves, get the politics out, allow themselves to go out there, take the steps they need to take when the government doesn't.
And I find it very hard to believe that they are going to successfully sell this building to a developer. I think the resistance of the people will prevent that from happening. People will fight that. So until it's back as a homeless shelter where it belongs, it's probably going to stay abandoned, a symbol of the stupidity of government.
below the intersections of Euclid and Champlain Streets in Adams Morgan, a developer is planning to build a 10-story luxury hotel. To do so, they plan to demolish the building containing the city paper and WPFW Pacifica Radio, and tear down multiple low-income apartment buildings, displacing over 220 people as bad as the Deauville fire, many of these folks Latino families of Native American descent. That means this proposal is a direct continuation of the Indian Wars, in which greedy newcomers drove Native American people, long-standing residents, from their homes and have been continuing to do so over the last 520 years. On the 14th of July, activists and area residents staged an affordable housing tour and movie night in the park across from the proposed hotel, showing how-to movies on the kind of tenant organizing that has saved other buildings in the neighborhood from similar development proposals. Here's what some people had to say in front of one of the threatened buildings.
Another 15 units. That's another 45, 50 people. That building right there is another 25 units. That's another 100 people. So we're talking just on this block. We're not talking about other blocks over here. Just on this block, we're talking about 200 potentially people being displaced by this hotel project.
That's as bad as the fire.
Estamos hablando que un edificio aquí con 15 unidades y otro edificio que con 45 units, más 45 unidades, van a ser más de 200 familias que se van, y este edificio más de 200 familias que van a sacar de aquí para hacer este hotel para los ricos.
Benito. Aquí estamos de la bicicleta para abajo.
Okay.
Sí. So this is why we're here today. We've gathered to just start beginning to talk about this. We're a little late in the game, but we need to organize quickly.
Estamos un poquito atrasados en el proceso, pero tenemos que organizarnos rápidamente, ya, rápidamente.
All of this is going to displace these people, all the people that have been here for many years. This is not fair. This is not what we want. We don't want a hotel here. We want a job training center. We want a community center. That's it.
The residents, the folks down here at the corner fought for their housing back in the late 90s. They said when the developer came in, right there, Champlain in Colorama, when the developer came in, to push them out when they were doing all this, before all this development came, the folks said, no, we will not be moved. And they're still there.